We're in our last segment of a series called The Good Life, and here's the idea that if you belong to Jesus and you devote your life to doing life Jesus' way, there's a good life ahead. It's not a perfect life, it's not a life without hardship and heartache, but it's a good life, full of what Jesus describes as his blessing, or the happiness that comes from God, that God gives us. It's more of a joy which resides within, and that is to be compared to the happiness that is circumstantial that you get because things are going your way. And Jesus is teaching that when you belong to me, you're going to do things a new way. The heart is going to matter. Your motives are going to matter. And if you do things my way, your life is going to be full of happiness. It's going to be happiness that comes from heaven. And if you devote yourself to applying my teaching, this teaching, by the way, that we can read in the Gospels, but specifically to my teaching, then you'll experience this good life. Now, we're at the stage of our modern culture where even the secular humanist social sciences has discovered this. You may have come across this recently, but in 2013, there was a study published in a journal called The Social, Psychological, and Personality Science. And after a long bit of analysis from the data that came from their research, they actually were researching the relationship between ideology, the way you live your life, political ideology or worldview, and your subjective sense of well-being. How are they connected? And here's what they discovered. Individuals who hold a conservative biblical values reported in this research higher levels of life satisfaction, number one. In other words, they subjectively reported that their lives felt more satisfying. They also reported that they had a greater sense of happiness. They were both happy and satisfied. And thirdly, they reported positive affect, meaning they felt better. They had more positive emotion than those who didn't. So, conservative biblical values, the people who applied those principles to their life, it was discovered by a secular humanist journal and research network that those people live the good life in some way, shape, or form. And even if they don't know that they're living by and applying these principles that Jesus gave us, they felt more, overall, they felt happier and they felt like they had a better well-being. Now, I'm fascinated by stuff. I'm fascinated when non-Christian scientific psychiatrists and psychologists discover things that we've known all along. I remember when I heard Dr. Phil first lead somebody to reconcile. How old is Dr. Phil? When he first started with Oprah, what was that? Was it 93 years ago? Is that right? I remember seeing it in black and white. The TV was black and white. But I remember when Dr. Phil, I was kind of a growing, emerging young church leader, and I was working through my own experiences with counseling, and I remember when Dr. Phil basically said this to a couple that needed to reconcile. I don't know what the dispute was, it doesn't matter, but they needed to reconcile, and here's what he said. He basically said, y'all need to confess that you hurt them. Then you need to ask them for forgiveness. Then you need to do the work of working through forgiveness, meaning that you decide that you no longer want them punished. And then when you get to those stages, you don't have to be BFFs forever, but you need to reconcile and be right relationship with each other. That'll make you happier and you happier. And I was like, you stole that from the Bible. That is the Christian faith way to deal with people given to us by God. And not only that, with the ultimate model being Jesus reconciling us to the Father through the self-sacrifice of the pain of forgiveness. Old Dr. Phil, it's been gratifying ever since to discover in these types of sciences that the application of the Christian faith, whether you're a Christian or not, brings a level of happiness and joy and well-being to one's life. But we don't have to rely on research. We can go right to the source. We can go right to the main page. We can go right to Jesus' teaching when he says things like this. In my kingdom, you should discern between two kinds of teachers and disciples. There's two kinds of teachers and disciples. And in my kingdom, you need to be discerning about the differences. Now, today, this segment that Jesus is teaching in the book of Matthew is essentially a warning. So I get the responsibility and also kind of the thrill of being a part of God warning his church about a couple of things that have life-altering, life-damaging, life-destructive potential. And Jesus warns us. He says, hey, I don't want you to be surprised when you discover these kinds of teachers and these kinds of disciples. I don't want you to be surprised at the destruction that will follow if you aren't more discerning. I don't know about you, but I often think that there's evidence of a lack of discernment in our world just by talking to people who have fallen for the latest exercise and fitness infomercial and bought a product that doesn't work, it never worked, it didn't even look like it was going to work, and they own it. If that's you, I'm praying that you get God's discernment the rest of your life so you don't have any of those things in your basement in the box. But it occurs to me that if people had more discernment, they would put phonies out of business. Isn't that true? If we had more discernment, people who are counterfeiting, people who are phonies, whether it's preachers or health and fitness or whether it's doctors or whatever, if people had more discernment, we could put them out of business. Jesus expects that people who belong to him and who are in his kingdom would begin to put out of business false teachers. And that we would certainly have discernment in our own life. So this last segment answers this life-altering question. How can I protect my life among Jesus' church? Here I am, I'm among Jesus' church. I have, whether I'm new to Jesus' church or I'm not new, I'm a wise, maturing, veteran belonger in Jesus' church, doesn't matter. Here's the question. How can I protect myself? How can I protect myself? And if you've had a life-damaging experience among Jesus' church, you're already asking this question. And I'm going to guess that if you've never been hurt by people within the church, you probably aren't asking this question because there's a default response, which is to be, how could anybody in Jesus' church hurt anybody? There's no way I'm ever going to be damaged because these are good people serving a loving God. And then eventually everybody comes to that wake-up call where you're like, oh, these are good people who have hurts, and these are good people who are still wrestling through their own self-centeredness and their own issues with being human. So basically, this is what Jesus says. You ready for this one? Here's how that you can protect your life among Jesus' church. Well, let me start by saying one way isn't to devote yourself to isolation. This is just a throw-in. This isn't what Jesus says, but it's actually going to be the opposite of that. Hang in there, hang with people, and let God do the work that he plans to do. But we basically, Jesus says, watch out for two forms of destruction. There's many more, but here's two that he highlights. One is deceptive Christian teachers. And I can't tell you how ironic and how sometimes awkward it feels that I am going to spend most of our time today trying to help you avoid getting hurt by people like me. What a thrill that is. Deceptive Christian teachers is one form of destruction. And secondly, disobedient Christian living. Deceptive Christian teaching and disobedient Christian living. Here's what Jesus says. He basically says, watch out for deceptive Christian teachers. And, you know, technically we could have put this word Christian in what's this? Quotes. These are air quotes, right? That changes everything. That changes everything. You know what I'm saying? A preacher can say anything they want if you just do that. So he says, watch out for deceptive Christian teaching. Now, I need to confess something to you. That this topic gets me hotter than most topics because it hits close to home. Because of the pain that this has caused my home when I was growing up, it's actually something that I'm a little bit more, if I come off a little, I don't know what the word is, if there's a little edge, I hope there's no edge. I hope that if there's an edge in me addressing this topic, it's because it deeply damaged people I love. And so I'm not angry about it, and I'm not bitter about it, but it's frustrating. It's frustrating that, and here's why it's frustrating, because people that it damaged are my parents, and there continues to be people like my parents who are being damaged by this. And that's why it's agitating to me. So, of course, we're probably all familiar with deceptive TV preachers. And to this day, they still teach this kind of deceptive principle, biblical principle called seed faith. And it's been distorted into a financial principle. And the financial principle is that if you plant a small financial gift that, or this financial gift seed, if you plant it, that you can expect to reap a financial harvest, okay? So seed faith is a biblical principle, and the TV preachers have distorted it into being a financial principle where you seed that financial gift. And by the way, I have to mention that you'll notice that they want you to plant that seed, they want you to invest that seed, not in your local church, not in someone else's world-class, high-impact ministry. Where do they want you to plant that seed, that financial gift? In their ministry, right? So, and if you do that, you should expect God to give you a financial increase, a harvest. Tiny little seed, you plant your gift, you get a financial harvest. So my mom bought it. She went all in on it. And they were a single-income family. And we ended up living in a trailer park that we couldn't afford, and so we moved in with my aunt. So we squeezed into her double wide, and we always joked as a teenager, we moved uptown in the trailer park. We went from downtown to uptown near the clubhouse. So my mom, I discovered later in my adult life, after talking through a lot of this with my mom, she accepted this seed faith giving challenge on TV. And one of the TV preachers gave this giving challenge. It was a $1,000 vow of faith every month. And I could hear you cringing, right? So the TV preacher, who she doesn't know, she just sees them for a half hour on television every day, gives this challenge. It's called if you give this seed faith, this vow of faith, $1,000 a month, and if you do it with big enough faith, then God is going to bring, he's going to bring you an increase. And by the way, God promises to do that. So if you don't get your increase, your faith isn't big enough. So keep focusing on building your faith. And if you can build your faith, you're eventually going to get this financial windfall, and then you can thank God for sending it to you because he always keeps his promises. So one day, my mom waves this envelope. I didn't know at the time how much that she was giving, but I knew she was a faithful giver to the TV preachers. And so one day she waves this envelope. I got it. Got my increase. And by the way, I should add, I don't want to forget to say this. I wholeheartedly believe that God honored my mom's faith. God worked in ways that were beyond what we could see, separate from TV preachers damaging my family and my parents. God honored her faith. In fact, there's proof that that's true in the New Testament when essentially Paul says, the truth is the truth. It doesn't matter what kind of corrupt vessel is delivering it, the truth is the truth. And I believe that that was true for mom. So she weighs this envelope and she said, here it is. What's that, mom? Got my increase. An unexpected rebate check came in the mail. And I was kind of like, if this is real, I'm ashamed of myself. I am going to start emptying my $10 a week into whoever. And so I opened it up, you know, and of course, I was kind of struck that it's like $75. And I said, Mom, if you do the math, I think this is a decrease. I think you got a decrease. But isn't it precious a bit that my mom didn't care about the number? She was doing something for God and believed that God did something for her. I love that about my mom. I love that childlike faith that my mom always expressed. What I didn't like is that $12,000 a year out of my dad's very, very modest union income was getting sent away to somebody to build their third and fourth house on the shore around the world. I don't believe that the responsibility is on the TV preacher to shut their business down because it's fraudulent. And I don't think that Jesus thinks that either. I think Jesus thinks it's our job to be so discerning that we put them all out of business. And that if we recognize that giving to God is not a spiritual slot machine where you just keep making deposits and making these giving gifts and pulling the lever and hoping that one day you hit your jackpot. And in some ways, you can see how this teaching is a shortcut to getting rich quick with the sanctification of God, basically. And it kind of, I think, unfortunately, encourages people to play some kind of spiritual, financial slot machine, and you're and just waiting to hit the jackpot. So, the damage is the damage in my family. There's a lot of ways to consider the damage, but one of the ways that our family was damaged is that we were stuck in my aunt's home for they were stuck in my aunt's home the rest of their lives, living with somebody else in their own home, and a lot of that I think was very, very difficult for my dad to accept. I think I've mentioned this to you. It was so difficult for my dad to accept that he would get bills. I've told you this before. This is crazy. How many of you pay your bills on time? No fail. Raise your hand. No fail. Okay. You might want to cover your ears on this one. We discovered long into our adult lives that my dad kept a bag behind his driver's seat in his van full of bills, invoices, unopened. So those of you who pay your bills, imagine this. Imagine you get your bill and you're like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do with that. And driving around for years with a bag full of unopened bills and invoices. And it also explains why when the phone would ring, my dad would say, don't pick that up. That answers the question. So, but I feel for my dad because he was put in that position by emptying ourselves into somebody who was exploiting them through spiritual principles. And Jesus says, beware of false prophets. We might better understand this as false teachers. Beware of them. In other words, it's our responsibility to beware that they exist and that they're out there disguised as harmless sheep. It's interesting, right? Jesus doesn't say, I want you to be careful because there are times you're going to be together when these wolves come in and they're just going to start tearing people apart with their false teaching. They don't look like wolves. They, unfortunately, look like regular folks. They also look like regular pastors. They look like people who can be trusted, who are actually harmless. But it turns out they're disguised as harmless sheep. They're vicious wolves. And their intent is for their own glory. Their intent is for their own enrichment. And their intent is for division and to undermine and to kind of subvert any kind of authority that is working properly in and among the church. So there's two assumptions here of Jesus. Number one, that there is false teachers among the church. And that they have a dangerous message. Their message is false. That's what makes it dangerous. Also, they have a deceptive look. They look harmless, but they're not. Then there's another assumption that Jesus makes, which is there's an absolute truth and they're deviating from it. Jesus doesn't make the assumption that all truth's relevant and you're going to hear different things that are true and it's true for everybody and it's your truth and my truth and then someone else has a different truth. And what Jesus is saying here is that there's truth and false teachers, the assumption is, they deviate from it. So Jesus was referring specifically here to Pharisees and Sadducees. The Pharisees, real quick, the Pharisees said, in order to win and keep God's approval and acceptance, you have to follow the rules. It's faith in Jesus plus performing, following the rules. And the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection. They were like, okay, teaching is fine, but nobody's really ever going to believe that there is an empty tomb and that one day Jesus is going to raise his followers from the grave either. So they were sad. There were Sadducees that did not believe that. So Jesus also implied false teachers would increase, that as time would go on, the gospel is going to go out, but also the false gospel was going to continue to increase over time, that that was going to begin to expand over time. And that deceptive teaching happens among churches like ours is a fact, when a teacher deviates from the absolute gospel truth. What are the prevailing false teachings? What should we be discerning of? Jesus doesn't describe them all, but we have some in the modern church. There is a mini list of dangerous false teachings that kind of are gospel-related for the most part, and maybe in one way they're not, but one of them is the prosperity gospel. And this is a part of what my mom took the bait on and went for, and not just her, but, I mean, limitless numbers of people. Anybody else know people, love people who took the bait? And it's agonizing, right? So the prosperity gospel is basically this: in exchange for and as a reward for your big faith, that God actually favors you. He gives you physical health and financial wealth as a reward or in exchange for your big faith. And that he's promised to do that. And if you don't have it, it's not because he's not keeping his promise, it's because you need bigger faith. And if you had bigger faith, then you can expect more health and more wealth. Or you can expect your life to kind of be enhanced. You can expect to get the promotion. You can expect to put your bid on the house that everybody wants, and there's 10 bids, and it's a cash-only bid, and there's an escalator clause and whatever, and you get it. And you get it because you had so much faith that God rewarded you for it. And that's the idea, that your life can be enhanced with material or vocational blessings, or you can get healthy and wealthy. You don't need to humbly repent for your heart idols that you're overspending on a house you don't need, and that's why you're not getting the winning the bid. This is hypothetical. Nobody here does that. This is hypothetical. But instead of repenting for your heart idols in finding your satisfaction in Jesus, we're left to believe that we just need to have more positive thinking and a bigger faith. Does that make sense? We've come across that. So in other words, God blesses you not because he's gracious, but because you're working the system. And you're working the system effectively. And I can't help but say this. I mean, remember when Jesus was talking about moving mountains? How much faith? Remember, we just did this. Just a tiny mustard seed. That's it. God is at work with a tiny mustard seed of faith. And sometimes he doesn't work because there's no faith. And he's not just, he's not a circus act trying to entertain people. So, secondly, there's a performance gospel. A lot of us are very familiar with this, maybe more familiar with this than the prosperity gospel, which is you can behave your way into God's approval or you can behave your way out of God's approval. When Jesus teaches that the only work that I have for you disciples is to believe. And that seems so unbelievable, that's the only work. Believe and trust. Then God justifies you, not by your performance, but by the performance of Jesus. Not by your self-sacrificing obedience, but by Jesus' self-sacrificing obedience. It's completely 100% based on his grace and not on my performance and my effort. Okay, there's all kinds of little strands in which the church gets tormented by performance gospel. By the way, if you're performing well, who gets the glory? I do. Or we do. Right? If I'm performing well, I get the glory. That's another aspect of it. So the next one is universalism. This is another kind of modern, we would call it maybe a dangerous false teaching is universalism, and that is that God is so loving and gracious that in the end, he saves everyone. That he doesn't only save people who have faith in Jesus, that everybody is a part of his salvation, regardless of their faith in Jesus, regardless of whether they have never repented, regardless of if they've been following another spiritual leader or guru. Eventually, everybody gets to the top of the same mountain, and God is like, well, I'm very merciful and gracious, so you're all that stuff I said about a narrow road, never mind. You're all in. So universalism also, I can understand the universalist who is trying to identify that there's no way that God has it in his nature to separate himself, and that there's no way God would allow someone to be punished like that. And I could certainly understand where they're coming from, but the idea that Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and he didn't mean it, that he meant there are many ways, or any way, is really, really hard to swallow. So another teaching that's a main cause of painful division, we're experiencing this in the U.S., in the United States, the church of in the U.S. right now, which is individual autonomy, which is not really a gospel, but it's the idea, this is causing a lot of division among God's church here in our country, and it's individual autonomy. And it's one example would be this. It's the belief that the individual determines and designs their own identity, that the individual gets to decide what it is, determine what it is, and to actually design who they are. And of course, we know that's related to whether it's, especially in the gender category, that a person must deviate from traditional biblical truth, that identity is biologically designed and determined by their creator or their heavenly father. And that each person lives to humbly receive that identity, not design it and determine it on themselves. And when someone does that, and there's a whole list of categories in which somebody does that, when somebody says, I reject the way that God designed me and I reject what he's determined for myself, that's somebody who's saying, I am living as my own God. I myself get to determine things that God determines, and I get to design things and redesign things that God designs. Right? What would we call that? We would call that individual autonomy. And you see this you just go back to Genesis chapter 3 and you see Adam and Eve saying, I am doing things my way. And I mentioned this last week. Sin is essentially them saying, leave me alone. Leave me alone. I design, I determine, I do my own thing. We would call that individual autonomy. So one example of receiving God's design and receiving God's determination for my own identity is accepting my race as my race, right? How else should we identify them? Jesus says you can identify them by their fruit. That is, by the way they act. So when you're trying to discern who are the false teachers, it's tempting to say, what are they saying? Jesus says, pay attention instead. What are they doing? What are their actions? How are they functioning? Judge the way they act, not just their charismatic and insightful words, right? This is why there's extra trouble for those of us who consume social media preachers. When you consume TV preachers, social media preachers, Instagram preacher, YouTube preacher, when you're consuming those kinds of preachers, there is no way to inspect their actions. There is no way to know how somebody treats people. Some of the most heart-wrenching things I've discovered in the last few years is someone that I really respected and someone I really started to trust and someone who had credibility in my own leadership, I discovered some report comes out that they were terrible, terrible to the people in their church and to those people who were serving around them on their team. And I think to myself, of course, I don't have any idea who these people are. And can you imagine those leaders that we discover now among the church family who are sexually abusing people and growing wildly famous on the internet? Meanwhile, they know the truth of how dark and awful that person is, but no one else does because the presentation is so shiny and so slick and so clever and so compelling. And Jesus is saying, it's our responsibility to understand that when somebody is only giving you clever words, by the way, I should say, I don't also mean that everybody that you see on social media who's preaching is abusing people, right? Is that fair to say? I mean, I don't believe that. But it's painful for people to know the real person and then see them wildly successful because nobody has any. Jesus says, basically, that should not happen. We can identify them by their fruit. That's the way they act. Just look and see the way they act. And that's some of the beauty of the local churches. I have to live among you all. You have to live among myself. And you have to kind of tune in to whether or not I'm condescending and egomaniacal and arrogant and self-righteous and whatever. And those should be alarms. Like, this could be a false teacher who's working for their own glory and is willing to hurt, damage, and divide the church for one's own platform. So Jesus uses a metaphor to teach this, and he kind of uses this bad fruit metaphor. And if you're a farmer, you get this. If you are a gardener, you get this. If you don't do either of those two things, it might be a stretch. It might be a stretch. And Jesus says this, bad fruit reveals a rotten root. If you get a bad fruit, it tells you something. On the one hand, the fruit isn't very good, but even worse, you can actually detect that it's true that somewhere down underneath the surface where you can't see it, there's a bad, rotten root. So where did this principle come from? It's a metaphor that Jesus taught. He said, just as you can identify a tree by its fruit, so you can identify people by their actions. You can identify people by their actions just like you can identify a fruit. No tree can hide its identity for long. It's so cool. If you watch a tree long enough and you let the seasons go by, what do you discover over time? Some of you, I'm going to set you up if you do gardening and you do farm stuff. What do you discover about a tree if you wait long enough? What can you discover? This is so easy. I hope I didn't set you up to fail. What do you discover? Say it. What type of tree it is. One person had the courage to say it out loud. But I know more of you knew the answer. If you give it time and you watch, as the seasons go by, eventually you're like, oh. Now, some of you already know what kind of tree it is by the way that some other features, but for those of us who don't know, you're like, oh, I see, that's an apple tree. It's a pear tree. Because that fruit eventually reveals itself. And what Jesus is teaching here is pretty simple. Sooner or later, a false teacher betrays himself. Sooner or later, a wolf may disguise itself, but a tree cannot. So it takes time and seasons to be able to identify false teachers. Harmful weeds, if you have thorns and thistles, which is a word I love to say, if you have thorns and thistles, they cannot produce edible fruits, right? You don't get any grapes, you don't get any figs, you don't get anything useful that comes from a thorn, weed, thistle. The first kind of fruit which false teachers reveal their true identity in is their area of character and conduct. It can be seen, it can be noticed, and some of our most prominent leaders in the last 10 years have kind of come down and collapsed specifically related to their actions, their character and their conduct. Jesus encourages us to look for whole relationships in a leader's life and look for love that's demonstrated in the life of teachers. What is the fruit of sound doctrine? It's not the intellect. The fruit of sound doctrine is love. Someone with sound doctrine becomes more and more loving, like the Father in heaven, who in essence is love, right? And what does Paul teach? Paul says, you may have understand all mysteries. You may speak with tongues of men and angels, right? You may be able to, literally, you might be able to do all these magical spiritual things, but if you don't have love, it's irritating to the Father who is love, and that's the fruit we're looking for in teachers. So we reject as false both teachers who have both broken and unhealthy relationships and who are unloving. So to apply this, we cannot really apply, and this is where I think we have to be so careful, we can't really apply this by our superficial estimate of how popular a preacher is or a teacher, right? Or how their book is a bestseller. Or by how many followers they have. And no matter how clever their words, in fact, I often think if their words are clever and they're more popular, they're even more suspicious, if you ask me. I finished the word for those of you who are adults. So we have to rely on a close and critical scrutiny, and we look closely at a teacher's character, conduct, their message, and their motives and their influence, and is it consistent? And that's why churches should take on the task of leading with elders among a team or a group of people who hold each other accountable and can really influence change when somebody is straying. So Christians who are gentle, loving, patient, self-controlled, demonstrating the fruit of the Spirit. So when you're thinking about what fruit are we looking for here, we're actually looking for the fruit of the Spirit. And when you come across someone who is impatient, unloving, and harsh, and you come across a teacher who doesn't control themselves, you have a sure sign they're not operating in the Spirit, and the fruit of that root is being demonstrated. It seems so simple in those occasions, doesn't it? It seems so easy. And as you know, when you know and love people in your own church and your leaders, it's difficult. So discerning teachers doesn't mean judging and condemning. I recently came across a YouTube star who is basically the apostate police. So he's going around and he is gathering all the promotional pieces and all of the conference speakers and all of basically anybody and everybody who he's seeing online, and he is categorizing them as apostates. And that's his full-time job. And I don't think that that's the spirit of what Jesus is saying here. I don't think Jesus is saying, hey, start up a hobby. Live your life to be condemning and rejecting and judging. Instead, I think he says, a good pastor is going to feed their flock, have discernment if there's feeding, if it's a good pastor. A good pastor is going to care for and bring truth that brings unity among the church family. And possibly even focus on the essentials of the Trinity God and the divine and exclusive nature of Jesus, along with the reliability and authority of the Bible, and how one is saved by faith alone. And every false teacher is going to divide with errors in those specifics. And a professional clergy, by the way, a professional clergy just doesn't do anything and lets the wolves terrorize the flock. Out of fear, the professional isn't willing to do it. So there's another warning that Jesus gives us too, and he says that not every impressive teacher is harmless or even a Christian. Not every impressive teacher is harmless or even a Christian. Now, this is kind of fascinating if you consider this, right? Because it's one thing to think, I'm listening to a Christian teacher that's behaving badly. They might be a false teacher. But the interesting thing is, it's also possible that they don't even belong to Jesus. And that's hard for me to get my mind around, is that, you think about it, the book of Acts is loaded, I guess, with people who are trying to get the power of Jesus for their own benefit, for their own wealth, right? So who does enter heaven? Check this out. Not everyone who calls out to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, only those who actually do the will of my Father in heaven, Jesus says. Only those who do the will of my Father in heaven. Only those who are living submitted to the Father in heaven will enter heaven. On judgment day, many people are going to say, Lord, we prophesied in your name. Lord, we cast out demons and we did it in your name, not our own. Lord, we were there working with the people and working among the church, performing so many miracles in your name. Now, I don't know about you, but I've been around people who are publicly prophesying, casting out demons, and also kind of initiating miracles. And Jesus is saying, just because that's happening, they may not even be Christian. That's a head scratcher. They may say at the end, Lord, I was doing all this work and I was doing all this really high profile, very, very popular ministry. And Jesus says, I will reply to them, I never knew you. I never knew you. Get away from me, one who breaks God's heart. Youch. That's worth studying, I think. It's also more proof that there are people functioning among us who look like dynamic and world-renowned Christian leaders who may not even be Christian. That's intense. That's why we have to be so discerning. That's why we need help and we need the body and we need to know people over time. It also means that not every teacher you're seeing on YouTube, Instagram, or attending their church, or every Christian leader who you're reading or listening to in Sunday services will eventually end up with God and his people in an eternal heaven. It's fascinating to me. Results, this is also important, results do not indicate authenticity, right? Results, and I think this is probably true for a lot of us, results, I think, stall or kind of like really slow us down with our discernment. Because what we say is, good things are happening. Look at all this good ministry here that's going on, right? Demons are being cast out, miracles are happening, and for goodness sake, there's prophecies that are being shared and advanced. But the results do not indicate authenticity. So instead, we have to inspect their life fruit, not their ministry results. What else could destroy my life?